This is cassette number 19.
Caught in the grip of his powerful fingers and his burning glare, Nikki was unable to move. She was so close she could see his lice hopping at her.
Kadar Kardif! So, you recognize me, even like this?
She said nothing else, but her eyes must have said that she thought he was dead, for he answered her unspoken question.
Remember that little girl? The one you seem to care so much about. She urged the townspeople to save me. She refused to allow me to die there in the fire where you had put me. She hated you so much she was determined to save me. She selflessly devoted herself to caring for me, to helping her fellow man, as you ordered the townspeople to do. Oh, I wanted to die. I never knew a person could have that much pain and still live. As much as I wanted to die, I lived, because I want you to die even more. You did this to me. I want the Keeper to sink his fangs into your soul.
Nikki looked deliberately at his grotesque scars.
And so, for this you have come seeking your revenge? No, not for that. For making me beg, where my men could hear it. For allowing other people to hear me beg for my life. It was for that reason they saved me, and their hatred of you. It is for that that I seek revenge, for not allowing me to die, for condemning me to this life of a freak, where passing women toss pennies in my cup.
Nikki gave him a smooth smile.
Why, Kadar, if you want to die, I can certainly oblige you.
He released her arm as if it had burned his fingers. His imagination gave her powers she didn't have. He spat at her.
Kill me then, you filthy witch. Strike me dead.
Nikki flicked her wrist and brought her Dakra to hand. The Dakra was a knife-like weapon carried by sisters. Once the sharpened rod was stuck into a victim, no matter where, releasing her power into the Dakra killed them instantly. Kadar Kardif didn't know she had no power. But even without her power behind it, the Dakra was still a dangerous weapon that could be driven into a heart or through a skull. He wisely backed away. He wanted to die, yet he feared it.
Why didn't you go to Jagang? He would not have let you become a beggar. Jagang was your friend. He would have taken care of you. You would not have to beg.
Kadar Kardif laughed.
You'd have liked that, wouldn't you? To see me living off the scraps of Jagang's table. You would love to sit at his side, the slave queen, and have him see me fall into this, to watch as you two tossed me your crumbs.
Fallen to what? To see you wounded? You've both been wounded before.
He snatched her wrist again.
I tied a hero to Jagang. I would not want him to know I begged like any of the weak fools we have crushed beneath our boots.
Nikki pressed her Dakra against his belly, backing him off.
Kill me then, Nikki.
He opened his arms.
Finish it, like you should have. You never left a job incomplete before. Strike me dead, like I should have been long ago.
Nikki smiled again.
Death is no punishment. Every day you live is 1,000 deaths, but you know that, don't you, Kadar? Was I that repulsive to you, Nikki? Was I that cruel to you?
How could she tell him that he was, and how much she hated him having her as chattel for his amusement?
It was for the good of all that the Order used men like Kadar Kardif. How could she put herself, her own interests, above the good of mankind? Nicky turned and rushed off down the alleyway.
"Thank you for the penny,"
he called mockingly after her.
"You should have granted my request. You should have, Nicky."
Nicky wanted only to go home and scrub the lice out of her hair. She could feel them burrowing into her scalp. Chapter 64. Richard pulled away the fistful of straw. He brushed the fragments of grasses from his leather apron. His arms ached from the labor of rubbing the straw, lightly loaded with fine abrasive clays, against the stone. Yet when he saw the luster of the stone, the character of the high polish, the way the marble glowed, taking light deep into the stone and returning it, he felt only exhilaration. The figures emerged from a sparkling stone base of rough marble. The grooved lines of the tooth chisels used in opposing directions to shear off thin layers of stone were still evident on the lower calves, where the legs emerged. He wanted the statue to bear testimony to the hand of man and the figure's origin in stone. They rose up to nearly twice his height. The statue was in part a representation of his love for Kaylin. He could not keep Kaylin out of the work because Kaylin was his ideal of a woman, yet the woman in the statue was not Kaylin. It was a man of virtue with a woman of virtue joined in purpose. They complemented each other, the two universal parts of what it was to be human. The curved section of the sundial had been placed by Victor and his men several days before, when Richard had been working down at his job at the site of the Emperor's palace. They had left the tarp over the statue as they worked. After the ring had been set, Richard had placed the pole that served as the gnomon and finished the hand holding it. The base of the pole was fixed with a gold ball. Victor had yet to see the statue. He was beside himself with eager anticipation. As Richard stared at the figures, only the light from the window above entered the darkened room. He had been given the day from work down at the site in order to prepare the statue to be moved to the plaza that evening. In the rooms beyond the shop door, the hammers of the blacksmiths rang ceaselessly as Victor's men worked on orders for the palace. Richard stood in the near darkness, listening to the sounds of the blacksmith shop, as he stared up at the power of what he had created. It was exactly as he had intended. The figures of the man and woman seemed as if they might draw breath at any moment and step out of the stone base. They had bone and muscle, sinew and flesh, flesh in stone. There was only one thing missing, one thing left to do. Richard picked up his mallet and a sharp chisel. Looking up at the finished statues, there were moments when he could almost believe, as Kaylin insisted, that he used magic to carve. Yet he knew better. This was a conscious act of human intellect and nothing more. Standing there, chisel and mallet in hand, gazing at the statue that was his vision in stone, was a moment when Richard could savor the supreme achievement of having his creation exist exactly as he had originally conceived it. For this singular moment in time, it was complete. And it was his alone. It was for this moment pure in its existence, untainted by what others thought. For this moment, it was his accomplishment, and he knew its value in his own heart and mind. Richard went to one knee before the figures. He laid the cold steel of the chisel to his forehead and closed his eyes as he concentrated on what he had left to do. "Blade, be true this day." He pulled the red cloth tied at his throat up over his nose, so not to have to breathe the stone dust, then set the chisel to the marks in the flat place he had already prepared, just above the heart of the flaw. Richard brought the mallet down and began to carve the title of the statue in the base for all to see. Nicky, standing behind the corner of a building around a curve in the road, watched further down the hill as Richard left the shop where he had carved his statue. He was probably going to see about getting the team to move the stone. He closed the door, but he didn't put the chain on it. No doubt he didn't intend to be gone for long. Men were working all over the hillside at a variety of shops. Tradesmen from leather workers to goldsmiths contributed to a constant din of saws, grinding, and hammering. The ceaseless uproar of the labor was nerve-wracking. While many of the men coming and going gave Nicky a good look-see, her glare warned them off. Once she saw Richard disappear beyond the blacksmith shop, she started down the road. She had told him she would wait until he was done before she came to see it. She had kept her word. Still, she felt uneasy. She didn't know why, but she felt almost as if she would be invading a sacred site. Richard hadn't invited her to see his statue. He had asked her to wait until it was done. Since it was done, she would wait no longer. Nicky didn't want to see it up on the plaza of the palace along with everyone else. She wanted to be alone with it. She didn't care about the order and their interest in the statue. She didn't want to be standing with everyone else, with people who would not recognize it as something of significance. This was personal to her, and she wanted to see it in private. She reached the door without anyone accosting her, or even paying her any mind. She looked around in the bright, hazy mid-afternoon light, but saw only men attending to their work. She opened the door and slipped inside. The room was dark, its walls black, but the statue inside was well lit by light coming down from a window in the high roof. Nicky didn't look directly at the statue, but kept her eyes to the floor as she hurried around the huge stone so she could see it for the first time from the front. Once in place, her pulse pounding, she turned. Nicky's gaze rose up the legs, the robes, the arms, the bodies of the two people, up to their faces. She felt as if a giant fist squeezed her heart to a stop. This was what was in Richard's eyes, brought into existence in glowing white marble. To see it fully realized was like being struck by lightning. In that instant, her entire life, everything that had ever happened to her, everything she had ever seen, heard, or done, seemed to come together in one flash of emotional violence. Nicky cried out in pain at the beauty of it, and more so at the beauty of what it represented. Her eyes fell on the name carved in the stone base. Life. Nicky collapsed to the floor in tears, in abject shame, in horror, in revulsion, in sudden blinding comprehension. In pure joy. Chapter 65. After Richard had returned with the fine white linen he had bought to cover the statue until the ceremony the following day, he helped Ishak and a number of the men he knew from down at the site begin the slow process of sledging the heavy stone down to the plaza. Fortunately, it hadn't rained in a while, and the ground was firm. Ishak, knowing such business well, had brought along greased wooden runners which were placed before the hefty wooden rails supporting the wooden platform under the statue, so that the teams of horses could more easily pull the heavy load across the ground. After the statue was dragged out of the second set of greased runners, the men brought the ones left behind to the front, leapfrogging the statue as it was moved along. The hillside was white with the scree of waste stone, so the statue weighed considerably less than it once had. Victor had originally hired special stone-hauling wagons to move the block. They couldn't use them now because the finished piece couldn't be turned on its side or handled in such a rough manner. Ishak waved his red hat in his fist, yelling orders, warnings, and prayers as they had moved along. Richard knew that his statue could be in no better hands. The men who helped seemed to pick up Ishak's nervous tension. They sensed this was something important, and though the work was difficult, they seemed more pleased to be a part of it than they were about their everyday labor at the site. It took until late afternoon to move the statue the distance from the shop to the foot of the steps leading up to the plaza. Men shoveled dirt at the bottom of the stairs and packed it tight in order to ease the transition in grade. A team of 10 horses was taken around the other side of the columns. Long lengths of rope were passed through the vacant doorways and windows and then secured around the stone base in order to draw the sledge up the steps. The extra runners were laid on the leading edge of the dirt ramp, later to be moved up onto the steps as the statue progressed upward. Near to 200 men swooped in at Ishak's frantic screaming to help pull on the ropes along with the horses. Inch by inch, the statue ascended the steps. Richard could hardly stand to watch. If anything went wrong, all his work would tumble back and shatter. The flaw would destroy it all. He smiled to himself, realizing how silly it was to worry that the evidence of his crime against the Order might be ruined. When the stone had finally arrived safely up on the plaza, sand was packed underneath the platform to support its weight. With the sand holding the wooden platform secure, the heavy runners were removed. With the runners off, the platform was slid off its hill of sand. From there, it was a relatively simple task to coax the statue off the wooden base and onto the plaza itself. At last, marble sat on marble. Gangs of men with ropes around the stone base tugged the freed statue into its final resting place at the center point of the plaza. Ishak stood beside Richard when it was over, mopping his brow with his red hat. The entire statue and sundial was shrouded in its white linen cover, with lines securing it, so Ishak couldn't see what it was. Still, he sensed something of importance stood before him.
"When?" was all Ishak asked.
Richard knew what he meant. "I guess I'm not sure. Brother Narev is to dedicate the palace to the Creator tomorrow, before all the officials who have traveled to see how the money they've looted from the people is being spent. I guess that tomorrow the officials, along with everyone else who comes to the ceremony, are to see the statue along with the rest of the palace. It's just another display of the Order's view of man's place. I don't think they intend any unveiling or anything like that." From what Richard had learned, the ceremony was a matter of great concern to the brothers. The drain of the expense of the palace on top of the expense of the war required justification to the people who were paying that price not only with their sweat, but with their blood. The Fellowship of Order ruled through the Imperial Order, with the necessary collaboration of brutes to whom they gave moral sanction. While the brutes had easily crushed the bodies of those who had revolted, the brothers wanted to crush the ideas such revolt represented before they could spread, because it was such ideas that were the greatest threat to them. To that end, it was also important to inspire the officials, the minions of the Order's tyranny. Richard imagined that with scenes of man's depravity carved into thousands of feet of stone wall, the flock of far-flung officials of the Order were going to be given guided tours by the brothers of all mankind's failings, and thus coerced into their duty of turning over money they had already confiscated at the point of a blade they wielded under the moral sanction of the brothers through the Fellowship of Order. Such petty officials were allowed a slice for their service to the Order, but the brothers no doubt wanted to forcefully dissuade them from any grander notions. Under the direction of the brothers, the collective of the Order, like any autocratic ruler, ultimately ruled only by the acquiescence of the people, who were controlled either by moral intimidation, or by physical threat, or by both. Tyranny required constant tending, lest the illusion of righteous authority evaporate in the light of its grim toll, and the brutes be overpowered by the people who greatly outnumbered them. That was why Richard had known he couldn't lead. He could not bludgeon people into understanding that bludgeoning was wrong because their lives were of great value, whereas the Order could have them bludgeoned into obedience by first making people believe that their lives were of no value. Free people were not ruled. Freedom had first to be valued before its existence could be demanded.
"From what I'm told, it's to be a big event," Ishak said. "People from all over are coming to the dedication of the Emperor's palace. The city is full of people from near and far."
Richard looked around at the sight as the workers trudged back to their regular jobs. "I'm surprised none of the officials have come to have a look at the palace in advance." Ishak waved his hat dismissively.
"They are all at the gathering of the Fellowship of Order in the center of Altur Rang. Big doings. Food,
drink, speeches by the brothers. You know how the Order likes meetings. Very boring, I imagine. From what I know of such events, the officials will be kept busy hearing of the needs of the Order and their duty to get people to sacrifice to that need. The brothers will keep them all under tight rein.
That meant the brothers would all be busy. Too busy to come out to the site for the trivial task of checking a statue one of their slaves had carved. In the scheme of things, Richard's statue was insignificant. It was only the starting point of the stately tour of the miles of walls, displaying extensive scenes depicting the grand cause of the Order, as dictated by the brothers, under Narev's leadership. If the officials and the brothers were too busy to come today, the people of the city were not. Most would probably attend the events of the next day, but they wanted to get a sense of the place for themselves first, without the boring speeches that would drag out the ceremony. Richard watched many of those people go from one scene on the walls to another, their faces stricken with the desolate emotion of what they were seeing. Guards kept people at a respectful distance, and out of the labyrinth of rooms and hallways inside, now enclosed by upper floors, and in some places roofs. Now that the statue was set in place, those guards moved in to clear the plaza entrance. Richard had only gotten a few hours of sleep in the last week. Now that the statue was in place, exhaustion overwhelmed him. With all the work on top of so little sleep and little to eat, he was almost ready to drop where he stood. Victor appeared out of the long shadows. Some workers were leaving, but others would still be at it for several hours more. Richard hadn't even realized that it had taken the better part of the day to move the statue. With the heat of the work over, his sweat-soaked shirt felt like ice against his flesh.
"Here," Victor said, handing Richard a slice of lardo. "Eat, in celebration that you are done."
Richard thanked his friend before devouring the lardo. His head was pounding. He had done all he could to show people what they needed to see. With the work done, though, Richard felt suddenly lost. He realized only then how much he hated having finished, to be without the noble work. It had been his reason to go on. "Ishak, I'm dead on my feet. Do you think you could give me a ride in your wagon part way to my house?" Ishak clapped Richard on the back.
"Come, you can ride in the back. I'm sure Jory would not mind. At least he can save you part of your walk. I must stay here and see to the teams and wagons."
Richard thanked the smiling Victor. "In the morning, my friends, in full light, we will remove the cover and see beauty one last time. After that, well, who knows?"
"Tomorrow, then," Victor said with his sly laugh. "I don't think I will sleep tonight," he called after Richard.
The months of effort seemed to all come down upon him at once. He climbed into the back of Ishak's wagon and bid the man a good night. As Ishak left, Richard curled up under a tarp to shut out the light and was asleep before Jory returned. He was dead to the world as the wagon rolled away. Nikki watched as Richard departed with Ishak. She wanted to do this on her own. She wanted it to be her part. She wanted to contribute something of value. Only then could she face him. She knew precisely how the Order would react to the statue. They would view it as a threat. They would not allow other people to see it. The Order would destroy it. It would be gone. No one would ever know about it. Twining her fingers together, she wondered how to proceed. What should be first? Then it came to her. She had gone to him before. He had helped Richard. He was Richard's friend. Nikki rushed across the sprawling site of the palace and up the hill. She was winded by the time she reached the blacksmith's shop. The grim blacksmith was putting away tools. He had already banked the fire in his forge. The smells, the sights, even the layer of iron dust and soot gave Nikki a joyful flash of her father's shop. She understood now the look that had been in her father's eyes.
She doubted he had fully understood it himself, but she did. Now.
The blacksmith looked up without smiling as she rushed into his shop.
Mr. Casella, I need you.
His frown grew.
What's the matter? Why are you crying? Is it Richard? Have they...
No, nothing like that.
She grabbed his meaty hand and tugged at him. It was like tugging on a boulder.
Please, come with me. It's important.
He gestured with his other hand around at his shop.
But I have to clean up for the night.
She yanked again on his hand. She felt tears stinging her eyes.
Please, this is important.
He wiped his free hand down his face.
Lead the way, then.
Nicky felt a little foolish pulling the burly blacksmith along by the hand as she raced down the hill. He asked where they were going, but she didn't answer. She wanted to get down there before the light was gone. When they reached the plaza, guards were patrolling up at the top of the steps, keeping everyone off the plaza. Nicky saw Ishak nearby, loading long planks in a wagon. She called to him, and seeing the blacksmith with her, he ran over.
Nicky, what is it? You look a frightful...
I have to show you both a statue. Now!
Victor's scowl grew.
It will be unveiled tomorrow when Richard...
No! You must see it now!
They both fell silent. Ishak leaned close as he gestured covertly.
We can't go up there. It's guarded.
I can!
Nicky angrily wiped the tears from her cheeks. Her voice regained the quality of grave authority she had wielded so often, that dark intonation that had passed judgment on countless lives and sent people to their death.
Wait here.
Both men pulled back at the menace in her eyes. Nicky straightened her back. She lifted her chin. She was a sister of the dark. She ascended the steps at a measured pace, as if the palace were hers. It was. She was the slave queen. These men were hers to command. She was death's mistress. The guards approached her warily, sensing that the woman in black was a threat. Before they could speak, she spoke first.
What are you doing here?
She hissed.
What are we doing here?
One asked.
We're guarding the Emperor's palace. That's what we're doing.
How dare you talk back to me? Do you know who I am?
Well, I don't think I...
Death's mistress. Perhaps you have heard of me.
All dozen men straightened. She saw their eyes take in the black dress again, then her long blonde hair, her blue eyes. By their reaction to what they saw, it was obvious to Nicky that her reputation preceded her. Before they could say another word, she spoke again.
And what do you suppose Emperor Jagang's consort is doing here? Do you suppose I came without my master? Of course not, you idiots.
The Emperor,
several mumbled together in shock.
That's right. The Emperor is arriving for the dedication tomorrow. I have come to make my own examination first. And what do I find? Idiots. Here you stand with your thumbs in your ears while you should be standing to greet His Excellency as he arrives into the city mere hours from now.
The guard's eyes widened.
But no one told us. Where is he coming in? We haven't been informed.
And do you suppose a man as important as Jagang wishes his whereabouts to be known for any assassin in the neighborhood to find him? And if there are assassins about, here you fools stand.
All the men bowed urgently.
Where?
The sergeant asked. Where is His Excellency arriving?
He's arriving from the north.
The man licked his lips.
But which road from the north? There are any number of routes.
Nicky planted her fists on her hips.
Do you suppose His Excellency is going to announce his route beforehand? And to the likes of you? If only one road was guarded, then any assassin would know where to expect the Emperor, now, wouldn't they? All the roads are to be guarded, and here you stand instead.
The men bobbed and bowed nervously, wanting to leave to do their duty, but not knowing where to go. Nicky gritted her teeth and leaned toward the sergeant.
Get your men out to one of the north roads, now. That is your duty. All the roads are to be guarded. Pick one.
The men bowed repeatedly as they sidestepped away. After scurrying only a few feet, they broke into a dead run. She watched them collect other guards as they went. As they vanished out of the plaza, Nikki turned to the two startled men. They climbed the stairs, now unhindered by guards. Some of the people treading the cobblestone paths, come to look at the carvings on the walls, had heard yelling and turned to watch what she was doing. Women on their knees, praying up at the carvings in stone of the light shining down on depraved people, looked over their shoulders. As Victor and Ishak reached the top of the plaza, Nikki untied the line, grabbed the linen in her fists, and ripped the shroud off the statue. Both men stopped in their tracks. In a half-circle around the plaza, the walls were covered with the story of man's inadequacy. All around them, man was shown small, depraved, deformed, impotent, terrified, cruel, mindless, wicked, greedy, corrupt, and sinful. He was depicted forever, torn between otherworldly forces, controlling every aspect of his miserable existence, an existence incomprehensible in its cauldron of churning evil, with death his only escape into salvation. Those who had found virtue in this world under the protection of the Creator's light looked lifeless, their faces without emotion, without awareness, their bodies as unbending as cadavers. They stared out at the world through a vacant, mindless stupor, while all around them danced rats, through their legs wriggled snakes, and over their heads flew vultures. In the vortex of this torrent of tortured life, this cataclysm of corruption, this depravity and debauchery, rose up Richard's statue in bold, glowing opposition. It was a devastating indictment of all around it. The mass and weight of the ugliness surrounding Richard's statue seemed to shrink back into insignificance. The evil of the wall carving seemed now to be crying out at their own dishonesty in the face of incorruptible beauty and truth. The two figures in the center posed in a state of harmonious balance. The man's body displayed a proud masculinity. Though the woman was clothed, there was no doubt as to her femininity. They both reflected a love of the human form as sensuous, noble, and pure. The evil all around seemed as if it was recoiling in terror of that noble purity. More than that, though, Richard's statue existed without conflict. The figures showed awareness, rationality, and purpose. This was a manifestation of human power, ability, intent. This was life lived for its own sake. This was mankind standing proudly of his own free will. This was exactly what the single word at the bottom named it, life. That it existed was proof of the validity of the concept. This was life as it should be lived, proud, reasoned, and a slave to no other man. This was the rightful exaltation of the individual, the nobility of the human spirit. Everything on the walls all around offered death as its answer. This offered life. Victor and Ishak were on their knees, weeping. The blacksmith lifted his arms up toward the statue before him, laughing as tears ran down his face.
"He did it. He has done as he said he would. Flesh and stone, nobility, beauty."
People who had come to see the other carvings now began gathering to see what stood in the center of the plaza. They stared with wide eyes, many seeing for the first time the concept of man as virtuous in his own right. The statement was so powerful that it alone invalidated everything up on the walls, that it had been carved by man underscored its veracity. Many of them saw it with the same understanding Nikki had. The carvers wandered away from their work to come see what stood in the plaza. The masons came down from the scaffolding. The tenders set down their mortar buckets. The carpenters climbed down from their work at setting beams. The tilers laid aside their chisels. The drivers picketed their horses. Men digging and planting the surrounding ground set down their shovels. They came from all directions toward the statue in the plaza. People flowed up the steps in ever-expanding ranks. They flooded around the statue, gazing in awe. Many fell to their knees, weeping. not in misery as they had before, but with joy. Many, like the blacksmith, laughed as tears of delight ran down their happy faces. A few covered their eyes in fear. As people took it in, they began to run off to get others. Soon men were coming down from the shops on the hill to see what stood in the plaza. Men and women who had come to watch the construction now ran off home to get loved ones, to bring them to see what stood at the emperor's palace. It was something the like of which most of these people had never in their lives seen. It was vision to the blind. It was water to the thirsty. It was life to the dying. Chapter 66. Caitlin pulled her map out and took a quick look. It was hard to tell for sure. She glanced up and down the road and noted that the other buildings were not quite as well kept. "What do you think?" Kara asked in a low voice. Caitlin slipped the map back inside her mantle. She snugged the fur up over her shoulders a little, making sure it covered the hilt of Richard's sword she wore strapped behind her shoulder. Her own sword was hidden under her cloak. At least the sun had just gone down.
"I don't know. We don't have much light left. I guess there's only one way to be sure."
Kara eyed the people who looked their way. For the most part, everyone in the city seemed remarkably incurious. With their horses stabled outside of the city, there would not be any swift escape if they needed to get away. The general indifference of people, though, somewhat eased Kaelin's concern. They had decided to simply be as aloof and casual as possible. She had thought they looked pretty simple in their traveling clothes, but in a place as drab as Altar Rang, the two of them had a hard time being inconspicuous. In retrospect, she wished they would have had the time to find something shabby to wear. Caitlin felt they were about as inconspicuous as a pair of painted whores at a country farm fair. She climbed the stairs to the place as if she knew where she was going and belonged there. Inside, the hallway was clean. It had the smell of freshly scrubbed wood floors. With Kara close at her heels, Caitlin moved down to the first door on the right. She could see the stairway farther down the hall. If this was the correct building, this would be the proper door. Looking both ways, Caitlin gently rapped on the door. No answer came. She knocked again a little louder. She tried the knob, but it was locked. After checking the hall again, she pulled a knife from her belt and worked it under the molding, springing it out until the door popped open. She grabbed Kara's sleeve and pulled the woman in with her. Inside, they both struck a pose, prepared to fight. There was no one in the room. In the light coming in from two windows, Caitlin saw first that there were two sleeping pallets. What she saw next was Richard's pack. Kneeling on the floor in the far corner, she flipped back the flap and saw his things inside. His war wizard's clothes were in the bottom. Near tears, she clutched the pack to her chest. It had been over a year since she had seen him. For almost half the time she had known him, he had been gone from her. It seemed she could not endure another moment. Caitlin heard a sudden noise. Kara seized the wrist of a young man as he charged in, brandishing a knife. In one fluid motion, she had his arm twisted behind his back. Caitlin thrust her hand into the air. "Kara, no!" Kara made a sour face as she lowered her ajil from the young man's throat. His eyes were wide with both fear and indignation.
"Thieves! You're thieves! That's not yours! Put it back!"
Caitlin rushed to the youth, motioning for him to keep his voice down.
"Is your name Camille or Nabi?"
The young man blinked in surprise. He licked his lips as he glanced over his shoulder at the woman towering above him.
"I'm Camille. Who are you? How do you know my name?"
"I'm a friend. Gadi told me."
"Then you're no friend!"
Before he could scream for help, Kara clamped a hand over his mouth. Caitlin shushed him.
"Gadi murdered a friend of ours. After we captured him, Gadi told me your name."
When she saw that he was taken aback by the news, Caitlin signaled for Kara to lower her hand.
"Gadi killed someone?"
"That's right," Kara said. He stole a quick glance over his shoulder.
"What did you do to him? To Gadi?"
"We put him to death," Caitlin said, not revealing the full extent of the deed. The young man smiled.
"Then you really are friends.
Gotti is a bad person. He hurt my friend. I hope he suffered.
It took him a long time to die, Kara said. The young man swallowed when he saw her grin from over his shoulder. Kalin gestured and Kara released him.
So, who are you two? He asked.
My name is Kalin, and this is Kara.
So, what are you doing here?
That's a little complicated, but we're looking for Richard.
His suspicion returned.
Yeah?
Kalin smiled. He was indeed Richard's friend. She put her hand to the side of his shoulder as she held his gaze.
I'm his wife. His real wife.
Camille blinked dumbly.
But...
Kalin's voice hardened.
Nikki isn't his wife.
His eyes brimmed with tears as a grin overcame him.
I knew it. I knew he didn't love her. I could never understand how Richard could have married her.
Camille suddenly threw his arms around Kalin, hugging her with fierce happiness for Richard. Kalin laughed softly as she smoothed the young man's hair. Kara seized his collar and pulled him back, but at least did it gently.
And you?
Camille asked Kara.
I am more...
Kara is Richard's good friend.
Camille unexpectedly hugged Kara then. Kalin feared the Mord Sith might crush his skull, but she endured it politely, even if she was ill at ease. Kalin thought Kara might even have started to smile. Camille turned back to Kalin.
But what is Richard doing with Nikki, then?
Kalin took a deep breath.
It's a long story.
Tell me!
Kalin appraised his dark eyes for a moment. She liked what she saw there. Still, she thought it best to keep it simple.
Nikki is a sorceress. She used magic to force Richard to go with her.
Magic? What magic?
He pressed without pause. Kalin took another breath. She could have used her magic to hurt me, kill me, if Richard didn't agree to go with her. Camille gazed skyward as he thought it over. He finally nodded.
That makes sense. That's the kind of man Richard is. He would do anything to save the woman he loved. I knew he didn't love Nikki.
And how did you know that?
Camille gestured at the two pallets.
He didn't sleep with her. I bet he slept with you when you were together.
Kalin could feel her face flushing at his boldness.
How do you know that?
I don't know.
He scratched his head.
You just look like you belong with him. When you say his name, I can see how you care for him.
Kalin couldn't help but smile through her weariness. They had been riding at a breakneck pace for weeks. They had lost a few horses along the way and had to acquire others. They had gone with little sleep for the last week. She had trouble even thinking straight.
So, do you know where Richard is now?
Kalin asked.
At work, I'm sure. He usually comes home about now, unless he has to work at night, too.
Kalin briefly scanned the room.
What about Nikki?
I don't know. She may have gone to buy bread or something. It's a little funny. She's usually home long before now. She almost always has dinner ready for Richard.
Kalin's gaze drifted through the darkening room from table to basin to cupboard. She would hate to leave, only to have him show up a minute after she left. Camille thought it was odd that Nikki wasn't home. That they were both gone was troubling.
This is the end of Side 1. This program is continued on Side 2 of this cassette.